Welcome to the Sydney J. Friedberg Lecture on Italian Art. In this lecture, presented on November 19th, 2017, Beverly Louise Brown discusses Titian's portrait of Clarice Strozzi at the age of two, now in the Gemälde Galerie collection in Berlin. A popular 19th century nursery rhyme explains that little boys are made of snips and snails and puppy dog tails, while little girls are filled with sugar and spice and all things nice. And who could be nicer than two-year-old Clarice Strozzi, who in Titian's portrait so sweetly shares a ring-shaped biscuit with her toy spaniel. Today, Instagram abounds in similar snapshots, eagerly sent by adoring parents to family and friends. Such images would seem to embody the essence of childhood by celebrating their subjects' natural spontaneity. They are lasting reminders of the days of childhood innocence. It's in this spirit that one might assume Clarice Strozzi's parents commissioned her portrait in 1542. But as Brown looks more carefully at Titian's charming portrayal of a little girl and her dog, she discovers that it is unlikely to have been a mere celebration of sugar and spice and all things nice.
It is a great honor to be back at the National Gallery and to be giving the Friedberg Lecture, and I really owe a great deal of gratitude to the Friedberg family and especially Catherine for making this series in memory of Sidney Friedberg possible. I had the great pleasure of first being a colleague of Sidney's at Harvard and then getting to work for him at the National Gallery. I originally came to Washington as someone just for a year to replace David Brown, who was on leave writing a book. And I was supposed to be working on the 15th century, which is what I'd been teaching at Harvard. And I got all my little Frangelico books around me, and I sat in my office, or in David's office, for 2 weeks. And Sidney came in one morning, and he said, "I want you to come with me to the Venetian galleries." So as we all know, that's sort of like a three-block walk from your office down to the other end of the building. And we stood in front of the Titians and the Veroneses, and he said, "This is what I want you to work on." So I knew, you know, I had heard of Titian. I'd heard of Veronese. I had not heard of Monte Mezzano or certain other people. I probably still don't know anything about him. But it was really Sidney who introduced me to Venetian art. And I have over the last, that was 35 years ago, over the last 35 years, on and off again, devoted quite a bit of time to looking at Italian art. And so I thought today it would be a very fitting thing to talk about something Venetian in Sidney's honor. And as Elizabeth said, I'm going to talk about one painting, a portrait of Clarice Strozzi by Titian, and that lives in the Gemälde Galleria in Berlin, where it was bought from the Strozzi family in the 19th century in 1887. And I would really like to thank people who aren't here today, but actually helped make this lecture possible in a very great way, which are the curators at the Gemälde Galleria, because surprisingly enough, this very well-known painting by Titian had never had any scientific investigation done. And so they took an entire scientific campaign for me on it. And you'll see some of the results of that today. A popular 19th century nursery rhyme tells us that little boys are made of snips and snails and puppy dog tails, while little girls are filled with sugar and spice and all things nice. And who could be nicer than two-year-old Clarice Strozzi, who in Titian's portrait so sweetly shares a ring-shaped biscuit with her toy spaniel? Well, perhaps only King Prince George, who on his third birthday, controversially, as it turned out, offered his dog Lupo a lick of ice cream. The British press went wild the next day because who knew, dogs are lactose intolerant. Today, Instagram is overflowing with similar snapshots of eagerly sent by adoring parents to family and friends. Sidney and Catherine Friedberg were no exception when their son played peekaboo with Veronese's young girl at the Villa Messer. And I'm sorry, Sidney, but Sidney Jr.'s chance encounter became a memorable Christmas card. Such adorable images seem to embody the essence of childhood by celebrating their subjects' natural spontaneity. They are lasting reminders of the household days of childhood innocence. It is in this vein that we might assume that Clarice's parents, Roberto and Magdalena Strozzi, exiles living in Venice, commissioned her portrait. But if we look more carefully at Titian's charming portrayal of a little girl and her dog, we soon discover that it is unlikely to have been a mere celebration of sugar and spice and all things nice. Titian's skill at capturing the buoyant effervescence of childhood was noted almost as soon as he laid down his brush. The portrait is one of the best documented pictures of his entire career. Not only is it signed Tizianus just below the dog, but a plaque on the wall behind Clarice states that she was two in 1542. It must have been finished shortly before the 6th of July of that year when the poet Pietro Aretino penned an open letter in praise of, quote, Titian's portrait of the little girl of Roberto Strozzi. It deserves, he wrote, to be placed before all the paintings that there ever have been or ever will be. I would praise the puppy that she strokes if it were enough to exclaim on the liveliness that animates it. In the 19th century, Crow and Cavacaselli echoed Aretino, calling Clarice one of the most sparkling displays of youth that ever was executed by any artist. Modern scholars, too, have seen her as adorable, engaging, enchanting, and playful. But above all, they have extolled Titian's picture as an innovative approach to portraiture in which a child is shown as a child. The sense of effervescent frivolity, however, that is generated by is not generated by Clarice, but by the two putti depicted on the marble relief decorating the nearby table. Now, I say table, although the piece of furniture as well as the setting are ambiguous. Is Clarice standing in a loggia or in a salone near an open window, looking out on a wooded landscape? It's impossible to tell, especially since all the elements are perfectly calibrated to the scale of a small child, not a realistic architectural setting. Tables with closed sides were common during this period, as were chests or cassones, which took the shape of an antique sarcophagi and could be used as a desk. But because the picture is truncated at the left, it is difficult to ascertain how far the table extends. Furthermore, it is partially concealed under a voluminous swath of crimson drapery, which is pulled aside to reveal the two putti. In contrast to the composed image of the young girl and her obedient dog, the putti have an energetic magnetism. The fluid brushwork bursts with visual excitement, making the time-worn and eroded surface of the pseudo-antique relief pulsate with life. It has been suggested that the putto on the right shares Clarice's features, imitating her upturned nose and curly hair. Clarice, it is therefore argued, is shown as a worthy heiress of antiquity. But surely the putti belong to a generic type, well known in antiquity and adopted by Titian in other works, such as The Triumph of Venus. The spirited putti in Clarice's portrait belong to a gallery of carved reliefs entirely invented by Titian, all antique portrait busts, fragmented statues, and sarcophagi that were strategically placed within paintings to elucidate their meaning. In Christ and the Adulteress, a medallion of the Emperor Augustus is embedded in the wall, which you can virtually not see, even standing in front of the painting. The soldier who points toward it helps to convey how Christ was able to avoid the trap set by the Pharisees by neither refuting their Judaic law nor usurping the power of the Roman authorities. The broken arm and vines creeping up the leg of an antique statue in The Miracle of the Speaking Babe indicate a passage of time, separating the past from the flesh and blood reality of the miraculous event below. While its fragmented state symbolizes the triumph of Christianity over paganism, its allusion to the justice of Trajan also provides a contemporary political commentary on the need for principled and temperate jurisdiction. This is the only time that Titian methodically copied a well-known piece of antique sculpture, although he substantially changed its meaning. For Bishop Jacopo Pesaro and Pope Alexander VI before St. Peter, Titian was able to craft the imagery borrowed from the small-scale gems into a coherent operatic sequence that captures both the essence of movement and the surface texture of a larger Roman relief. St. Peter's position above the All Antiqua relief symbolizes the church's victory over paganism, underscored by Cupid himself, who literally reaches for the keys to the kingdom of heaven. The marble relief becomes the rock, the foundation on which Christ built the church. Venus's pagan victory depicted on it can thus be read as an allegory of Christian victory shown above. In a painting that otherwise commemorates Jacopo Pesaro's ceremonial departure for battle, the relief alone alludes to his victory over the Ottoman infidels for the glory of the church. The complex relief in Sacred and Profane Love depicts a moral tale in which the bestial aspects of love are transformed through matrimony into a positive force for procreation. The eroded faces and bodies are deliberately ambiguous, and parts of the relief are hidden altogether behind the lush folds of drapery or partially obscured by the rosebush. The relief's narrative thus remains supplementary to the predominant division between the twin Venuses sitting above. So within this context of Titian's work, it might seem highly probable that his inclusion of the two spirited putti in Clarice Strozzi's portrait signifies something beyond mere merriment. It is the putti's inclusion in Clarice's portrait that I would like to look at more carefully this afternoon. But before I tell you what I think, I want to know what you think. They are frequently described as dancing, and one can point to a number of Renaissance prints, drawings, and sculptures that depict similar figures. Alternatively, they may be fighting. And there are also a number of prints and drawings that show little fighting putti that are sort of belligerently aggressive. As Charles Dempsey has argued, during the Renaissance, putti were seen as spiritelli, spirits, if you will, that could transmit a multiplicity of feelings and ranging from love and joy to fear and awe. So what exactly are we seeing here? Now, I would like you to vote. I'd like to know how many of you, this is not Brexit. This is not a non-binding referendum. You're going to get a chance to vote at the end of the lecture again. How many of you think that they are dancing? You just raise your hand if you think they're dancing. And how many of you think that they're fighting? So we have more fighters than dancers. As I said, we'll come back to this at the end, and then we'll vote again and see what you think then. Although there are classical depictions of beguiling innocence, such as the 4th century BC stele depicting young Melisto affectionately teasing her dog with a bird, naturalistic portrayals of children virtually disappear during the medieval period. And as much as I would like to tell you that Titian knew this stele, which is in the Harvard University Art Museums, I still think of it as the fog, but they don't. They changed their name, so what can I? After I left, they changed their name. And I'm sure that some of you, if I just showed you these two pictures, you would believe that Titian knew this stele. He may have known ones like it, but this was only discovered in 1961, so we know he didn't particularly know it. It was really only in the latter part of the 15th century that examples of child portraiture began to reappear with any frequency throughout Europe. Yet when they did, they were reminders of dynastic continuity rather than childhood innocence. A case in point is something, a painting that almost everyone in this room should know because it lives here in the National Gallery. It's Hans Holbein the Younger's 1538 portrait of Edward, Prince of Wales, which bears an inscription reading in part, "Little one, emulate your father and be the heir of his virtue." Edward was the sole male heir of Henry VIII, and despite his tender age, he is depicted with a serious demeanor of a ruling monarch. One hand stretches out to his subjects, sort of the Queen Elizabeth wave, and the other clutches a gold rattle as if it were a scepter or sword. Edward was a frail child, but Holbein has shown him as a sturdy and healthy lad, lavishly dressed as a miniature courtier. His puffy cheeks and pointy chin sort of mimic the countenance of his father's beefy jowls and well-groomed beard. Around 10 years later, Aretino wrote a letter to Titian urging him to finish his paintings of Henry and Edward. The pictures are untraceable, so we can only imagine how different Titian's vision of a young prince would have been. Perhaps, like his portrait of 12-year-old Ranuccio Farnese, it would have captured both the dignity of office and the vulnerability of youth. And as you all know, this painting, too, lives at the National Gallery. It was painted the exact same year as the Clarice Strozzi. And I urge you after the lecture to go up and look at it, because you never can see in reproductions how beautifully textured the black silk of the cape is. It is just exquisite, but very, very subtle. Ranuccio had been destined for an ecclesiastical career from the age of four, when his grandfather, Pope Paul III, appointed him prior of San Giovanni de Ferrani in Venice, a church belonging to the Order of the Knights of Malta. It was probably in August of 1541, when he visited the priory for the first time, that his portrait was commissioned from Titian as an aide de memoire for his mother, Girolamo Orsini, who remained in Rome. Glove in hand and sword at side, Ranuccio has been given all the trappings befitting his station, but the gloves are a bit too large, and the sword pulls heavily on the straps that tie it around his waist. The ceremonial cloak, emblazoned with the white Maltese cross, is perilously close to slipping off his slender shoulders, and his wide eyes expose a nervous trepidation as he stoically confronts his future. With amazing subtlety, Titian has captured the uncertainty of adolescence on the cusp of adulthood. Titian's responsiveness to children is also revealed in the Vendramin family venerating a relic of the True Cross, which was started around 1540 and probably finished before the artist left for Rome in 1545. The youngest member of the family, Federigo, who was born in 1535, appears not to be much older than five or six, and once again, it is his innocent charm that catches the viewer's attention. He and two of his siblings sit on the steps of the altar, distracted by a pet spaniel. Their boyish antics humanize the scene without destroying the solemnity of the occasion. Titian was able to exploit the potential of dynastic portraiture by transforming it into a meeting point of generations, where children are no longer simply seen as miniature adults. It is likely that the Vendramin children, as well as Clarice Strozzi, sat only briefly for Titian. When Ranuccio Farnese's portrait was sent to his mother, she was told that Titian's achievement was to be, quote, particularly admired since it was done partly in his presence and partly in his absence. Sitting for Titian could be a wearisome task for anyone, let alone the young. When Catherine, the 15-year-old niece of Emperor Charles V, was engaged to Francesco Gonzaga III, it was decided to send a portrait of her to Mantua in advance of her arrival. The picture, which can no longer be traced, was accompanied by a letter explaining that her face is somewhat more reserved than in life. But this is not the fault of the painter. For it seems that when her serenity had to sit for a long and tedious period, she became pensive, and as a result, her face appears less cheerful, gentle, and sweet than it really is. Titian most likely started his portraits by making drawings of the sitters' heads, or at least sketching their facial features onto the canvas before beginning work on their garments. Like other artists of the period, he borrowed clothing and jewelry in order to copy them without the sitter having to be present. We know that Francesco della Maria della Rovere sent his own suit of battle armor to Venice to facilitate Titian's work on his portrait, and that Giuliano Verano della Rovere's courtiers complained when Titian requested a crimson or pink velvet gown, since he could have sent a much more handsome one in another color. It is likely that Titian met Clarice only long enough for him to sketch her face. The rest of the picture, including the depiction of her magnificent and costly jewelry, would have been done over a period of time in his studio. Typical of his paintings from this period, the support is a roughly textured canvas on which fluid brush strokes were applied to outline the basic forms. The paint layers are extremely thin, giving you a sense that he painted it, and he probably did fairly rapidly, and the palette restricted, yet the textures and colors sparkle with a vibrant luminosity. New technical evidence shown here for the first time indicates that Titian made only minor changes as he painted, such as adjusting the position of Clarice's left eye. And if you can see right there where the eye changes position. It is clear from the infrared reflectogram that from the very beginning, Titian envisioned painting a full-length standing figure and made no major adjustments to the composition. While at this date, full-length portraits were rare in Italy, they were not unknown. Titian himself had painted a full-length portrait of Charles V with a dog in 1533, in which the emperor is depicted in the pose of a Christian knight. Despite the genial addition of the hound, it is an exaltation of princely dignity, what Aretino would later describe as a beautiful gesture of royal majesty. Luba Friedman has argued that Titian intentionally chose this format for Clarice's portrait to underline her social rank. Yet, for the two-year-old of a Florentine banker exiled in Venice to be treated with the same courtly magnificence as the emperor was unprecedented and perhaps even a bit presumptuous. This is not to say that the Strozzis were not well connected. To the contrary, they were one of the wealthiest families in Italy with banking connections throughout Europe. But Clarice's parental grandfather, Filippo, had come to Venice in 1534 under a cloud of suspicion. Up until then, as one of his kinsmen had said, he had made a point to always remain in discreet rapport with the Medici. In 1508, Filippo had married Clarice de' Medici, the granddaughter of Lorenzo the Magnificent. The young Clarice, in Titian's portrait, was named after her grandmother. Now, if you look at this, you can see there's Clarice up there at the top, and here's her father, and here's her grandfather, and here's her great-grandfather, the one who built the Strozzi Palace in Florence, and here's her grandmother, Clarice de' Medici. And on this side of the family, her mother, who's also a Medici, Maddalena de' Medici, is married to Strozzi's down here. So the two families, despite the fact having political differences and professional differences, are closely entangled by marriage. The Strozzis were cousins of Caterina de' Medici, the future queen of France, and in 1533, Filippo Strozzi had personally lent her uncle, the Medici Pope Clement VII, the 130,000 scudi needed for her dowry. Now, to give you an idea of how much money that is, if you were living in Venice at this time, you could only have 6,000 ducats. And it's sort of like euros to dollars. Ducats and scudi are more or less the same in this period. So you can see how many millions of times more her dowry was than the average one. And it nearly bankrupt Filippo Strozzi for doing this. And what I love in this picture where you can see them getting married is the money bag right there, which is making this all possible. So even though Filippo Medici had, or Filippo Strozzi had done this for the Medici, he was opposed to the new regime in Florence, backed by Clement, which saw the Republic replaced by a Medici Principate with the Pope's illegitimate son, Alessandro, as the new Duke. Sensing trouble, Filippo closed the Roman branch of his bank, declaring, "I've resolved to live in Venice because the place and its customs entirely satisfy me." We all feel that way. I mean, we all could, you know, say the same thing about Venice. There he was joined by a close-knit group of voluntary expatriates and forced exiles known as the Fuoriusciti, literally ones who had gone outside. The Strozzi's banishment from Florence became official in October of 1536 when Filippo and his sons, Piero and Ruberto, were declared rebels. The dramatic circumstances soon intensified when Duke Alessandro was assassinated by his cousin, Lorenzino de' Medici. After brutally stabbing the Duke, Lorenzino fled to Venice, where in the euphoria of the moment, he exacted a promise of marriage for his two sisters to Filippo Strozzi's sons. Hoping to restore the former government to power, Filippo raised troops for an assault against the new Duke, Cosimo Primo. But things did not go very well. On the 1st of August, 1537, in the Tuscan hills near Monte Murlo, Filippo was captured and imprisoned in the Fortezza del Basso in Florence. And there you can, there you can't see him, but he's the one in the middle. Not very well dressed for battle, maybe that's why he was captured. In December of 1538, it was reported that he had committed suicide in his cell, although it seems more probable that he died at the hands of the Medici. Exactly 1 year later, the double wedding between Lorenzino's sisters, Ludomia and Maddalena, and Filippo's sons, Piero and Ruberto, took place in Venice. It was said that Ruberto Strozzi had a rare judgment in all branches of knowledge. He gathered under his roof ensembles of amateur and professional musicians, and he commissioned madrigals from the most prominent composers of the day. He also studied the viola del gamba with Silvestro Ganassi, who in 1542, the very year the portrait is painted, dedicated a treatise to him aptly titled Regola Rubertina. After the family's exile, Filippo Strozzi had hired the noted Florentine humanist and poet Benedetto Varchi to tutor Ruberto in law and Greek letters. In Venice, Varchi was quickly absorbed into an elite circle of artists, poets, and literati. He counted among his friends Aretino, Pietro Bembo, Ludovico Dolce, and Titian, and he doubtlessly enjoyed soirees of the type described in 1540 when, quote, the most celebrated characters that are in this city, including Aretino and Jacopo Sansovino, listened to a varied harmony of music, of voices and instruments in Titian's beautifully laid out garden. It was around this same date that Titian painted his portrait. Like Aretino, Varchi admired Titian's portraiture for its verisimilitude, and it may have been through Varchi that Ruberto Strozzi became acquainted with the artist's work. In his Storia Fiorentina, Varchi showered praise on Ruberto's mother, Clarice de' Medici, extolling her virtues as a virile and spirited woman. He cast her as a heroine of classic or biblical magnitude, an ideal wife and compassionate mother who stood up against her cousin, Clement VII's attempt to usurp control of Florence's government. It is surely no coincidence that these are the very virtues embodied in Titian's portrait of her two-year-old namesake. Young Clarice Strozzi literally stands tall in her grandmother's image. The cimbella, or ring-shaped biscuit that her dog has nibbled at, resembles the crescent moons found on the Strozzi coat of arms. Unabashedly, she brands herself as a Strozzi while simultaneously displaying her maternal instincts by nurturing her pet. Her charitable act is reminiscent of the boy playing with a puppy in Titian's presentation of the Virgin, where the genre-like moment mimics the distribution of alms seen at the left. Cimbelle, which one might describe as donuts with rigor mortis, were, actually, I had a really good donut at lunch today and it didn't have rigor mortis at all. But these, if you've ever had one, could break off your teeth. They were dried cakes made from eggs. They were a way of preserving eggs, as a matter of fact, that could be kept for up to a year without spoiling. They were sold on the streets by vendors and taken to sea by sailors who wore them like bracelets. The sweeter versions were associated with holiday breads and concealed a sexual metaphor of fertility in their rounded shape with a hole in the middle. Today, bussola, meaning hole in Venetian dialect, are the speciality of the island of Burano. Traditionally, cimbelle were brought to a woman just after the birth of a child, but by the middle of the 16th century, they were also being served at the Este court in Ferrara and papal banquets in Rome. Clarice's dog is a red and white toy spaniel known as a papillon because its butterfly ears are shaped like butterflies. Lapdogs of this type frequently appear in paintings by Titian, and depending on the context, they have been given a variety of symbolic meanings. In the Venus of Urbino, the dog's juxtaposition with the reclining nude may connote female seduction, but if one believes that the picture was commissioned to celebrate a marriage, then perhaps the dog alludes to a couple's desire to have a child. We know that dogs were sometimes given as wedding gifts by a groom to his future bride. In 1536, Duke Alessandro de' Medici, remember the one who got killed, wrote to Isabella d'Este, who was known for her excellent pedigree of canines, imploring her to send him a puppy for his betrothed. Certainly within the upper echelon of society, lapdogs were the constant companions of women and were frequently included in portraits where their symbolism would have been patently clear. In Andrea Alciato's Emblemata, which was first published in 1531, dogs are equated with marital fidelity and fecundity. The inscription beneath Alciato's image of infidem exorum, or wifely fidelity, reads, "Behold, a young woman who joins hands with a man. Behold, how a dog plays at her feet. This is the image of fidelity. If the passion of Venus fosters this fidelity on her left, there will be a branch aptly bearing apples. Indeed, these are the fruits of Venus." Since antiquity, the harmonious union of brides and grooms had been symbolized by the clasping of right hands and the consent to marriage sealed by placing a ring on the betrothed finger. And when you put the ring on a finger, it was actually at the moment that the dowry agreement was signed. It wasn't actually at the marriage. It's more like what we would probably call an engagement ring. Clarice offers the cimbella to her dog with her right hand. The ring-shaped biscuit may allude not only to her dynastic lineage, but to a wedding ring and the potential promise of a fruitful procreation. Others have remarked on Clarice's potential as a prospective bride. She is, in fact, dressed for the occasion. An early travel album, compiled in Venice in the 1570s, depicts a bride wearing a flowing white gown with puffed sleeves and a type of belt known in Venetian dialect as a collana in sprara, which hangs nearly to the ground and from which dangles a scent-filled pomander. 20 years later, Cesare Vecellio reproduced a similar design in his book on ancient and modern dress. His inscription tells us that this bride has just been wed and now, wearing a beautiful white satin gown adorned with pearls and gold of great value, she can go out in public and enjoy dancing. We know that some Venetian brides did wear white gowns, similar to the ones pictured in the travel albums. In his 1581 Cultural Guide to the City, Francesco Sansovino described how a bride would be presented by her dance master, quote, dressed in white by ancient custom, with her hair flowing loosely on her shoulders, entwined with threads of gold. However, not all Renaissance wedding dresses were white. In fact, the most popular color was red. The most important element was their opulence, not their color. What really mattered was the conspicuous display of wealth through garlands of pearls and ropes of gold. In Venice, prostitutes were explicitly forbidden to wear pearls, but a woman might wear a single strand of them for the first 10 years after her marriage. Clarice's jewelry is unquestionably the type associated with betrothal and marriage. She wears a pearl bracelet and matching necklace from which hangs a pendant set with a ruby and an emerald, and she has a tiny diamond ring. The pendant, which could also be worn as a brooch, may have been passed down through the Strozzi family. One of the gifts that her grandmother, Clarice de' Medici, was given in 1509 to celebrate her recent marriage was a splendid ruby and pear-shaped pearl brooch. When Clarice Strozzi eventually married in 1557, her dowry included precious rings, chains, and other gold jewelry valued at 2,000 scudi. The marriage agreement stipulated that she would be allowed to keep the jewelry, and eventually she willed it to her daughter, Julia. As in images of Venetian brides mentioned before, young Clarice wears a collana inspirata, or perfumed belt, with a pierced pomander. The name pomander derives from the French for amber apple, because its hinged compartments were designed to house pellets of scented resin. And they opened up, you know, if you have those little apple cores, you press it down and then you get eight little perfect apple things. That's exactly how they would open up like that. And then they could all be closed back up again with the scent inside of them. The scent of amber in particular was thought to cure infertility and to slow down aging. They were a protective shield against any thing that any kind of mother-to-be would have been pleased to possess. Belts were also considered to be a sign of chastity, and they were traditionally presented as betrothal gifts to be worn in trust until the wedding night, when a groom would remove them from the bride's waist. Delicately woven into the gold links of Clarice's girdle are tiny enamel flowers meant to emulate diamonds, rubies, and sapphires. Gems were believed to harness virtues beneficial for wedded bliss. Diamonds ensured fidelity and concord, while sapphires might encourage marital chastity. In 1505, in a description of a Roman wedding, Marc Antonio Altiari explained that sapphires denote the soul and rubies the heart, burning with amorous flames, so that when they're worn together, they represented the gift of both soul and heart. For any prospective husband, Clarice's jewelry was not only a sign of her inner virtue, but a visual reminder of the Strozzi's wealth and the potential dowry she would bring to a marriage. Clarice's girdle swings from her waist like a pendulum, implying that her stride forward has been abruptly arrested as she turns in the opposite direction toward an unseen distraction. It is a seemingly spontaneous movement whose slight awkwardness has been interpreted as a sign of her immaturity. Michele Savonarola, a 15th century physician from Padua, and he was related to the famous Savonarola of Venice, advocated unrestricted play for toddlers under the careful supervision of a wet nurse. When a child was just learning to walk, they should be placed near a wall and encouraged to move forward by tossing them a toy or an apple. Now, perhaps this is why Clarice turns. Yet a sophisticated viewer would have recognized that her pose is a reversed variation of Lysippus's Cupid stringing his bow. And there you can see it reversed. Titian knew this celebrated antiquity through a copy belonging to the Grimani family of Venice. And a few years after he painted Clarice's portrait, he flipped it again for the figure of Cupid in his erotically charged Danae. Far from merely representing an ungainly step of a toddler, Clarice's gyrating pose is a sophisticated reminder that no marriage could succeed without the sting of love unleashed by Cupid's bow. There are further references to love and marriage hidden in the wooded landscape behind Clarice and her dog. Barely visible are two swans swimming in a pond, a metaphor of love since they pair for life. According to Boccaccio, Venus's chariot was pulled by swans, not only because their whiteness signified her feminine splendor, but also because they sang so sweetly near death that their harmonious music attracted the excessive passion of lovers. The goddess of marriage, Venus, presided over sexual desire that led to procreation. In Francesco della Cosa's Month of April in the Palazzo Schifanoia in Ferrara, Venus rides in a triumphal cart pulled by a pair of paddling swans. The elaborate celebrations for the 1475 marriage of Costanza Sforza and Camilla d'Aragona were recorded in a specially illuminated volume, which describes how the second course of the wedding banquet was dedicated to Venus, who sent her muse, Arato, to present her dishes. Arato carried emblems of a swan, which had a myrtle branch fastened around its neck by a golden girdle called seston, a girdle of chastity and fidelity. Seston, or sometimes in the ancient texts it's called sestus, was the name of Venus's girdle, which the goddess purportedly left behind on her many dalliances, since such incestuous behavior broke the sacred bonds of matrimony. Filippino Lippi's Arato, which was probably commissioned to celebrate a wedding, quite possibly Caterina Strozzi's 1502 marriage to Neri di Gino Capponi. As Titian's picture, Arato's pose is a subliminal reference to Cupid, the god of love and erotic desire. With the help of two rambunctious putti, she endeavors to harness the swan's more carnal tendencies by encircling it with Venus's golden belt of chastity. As Guarino di Verona noted, Arato gave to mortals matrimony and honest love. The swans in Clarice's portrait have been suitably tamed, but are nonetheless linked vertically to the two energetic putti by a swath of red drapery that has been pulled aside to reveal their presence on the all-antica relief. Like so much else in Titian's pictures, the putti can be associated with betrothal and marriage. Their most obvious source, however, is decidedly non-matrimonial. The reliefs, which once formed part of the throne of Saturn in Ravenna. The reliefs had been in Venice since at least 1335, when they were included on a list of antiquities then available for sale in the city. By the end of the 15th century, they were on public view over the archway leading from the Piazza San Marco to the Frizzeria. And in 1532, the Putti di Marmo were relocated to the church of Santa Maria del Miracoli. As authentic antiquities, they were thought to be by Praxiteles, they became a prime source for artists such as Titian, who used them as early as 1517 for the jubilant putti in his woodcut depicting the triumph of faith. The reliefs, of course, were not the only source for these types of figures. Similar spiritelli can be found in abundance in Roman art, especially on Bacchic sarcophagi, where infantile revelers drink, dance, and play musical instruments, or on ones depicting pancratic games, the athletic competitions in which lively children excel at boxing and wrestling. A century before Titian added his fictive relief to Clarice Strozzi's portrait, Donatello had already transformed funerary imagery of sarcophagi into a joyous celebration of heavenly paradise. Between 1428 and 1438, he executed six marble reliefs for the external pulpit of the Church of Santo Stefano in Prato. The pulpit is used five times a year for a ceremonial display of the most sacred relic in Tuscany, the Virgin's girdle. And That's the Virgin's Girdle up there. And there you can see in a present-day ceremony it being held up to the people down below. The pulpit is used 5 times a year to show this. According to the legend, the girdle had been obtained around 1140 during a trip to the Holy Land by Michele Dagomari of Prato. In Jerusalem, Michele had fallen in love with a local girl whose mother gave her the girdle as part of her dowry. Some 30 years later, Michele willed the precious girdle to Santo Stefano, and soon thereafter it became a popular pilgrimage site for women hoping to become pregnant. Touching, kissing, or even viewing the holy relic might be enough to cure infertility. The parallels between the classical myth of Venus's chaste belt and the Christian legend of the Virgin's girdle, which she had dropped to Thomas as she ascended into heaven, are obvious. While Donatello's joyfully dancing putti clearly celebrate the assumption of the Virgin, they simultaneously allude to the miraculous potency of the girdle as a symbol of fertility and the promise of happy, healthy offspring. Just as Venus's mythic girdle had been incorporated into a new Christian context, so too were the Bacchic revelers and playful children of Roman sarcophagi seamlessly transformed into the spirited progeny of a fruitful marriage. The association of putti or spiritelli with birth becomes clear in Domenico Ghirlandaio's Birth of the Virgin, which forms part of the late 1480s fresco cycle in the Tornabuoni Chapel of Santa Maria Novella in Florence. Like Donatello, Ghirlandaio turned to sarcophagi for inspiration, ones in which childlike revelers clang cymbals, play lyres, and struggle to help their companions stand upright after over-imbibing. And you can see how really, really close Ghirlandaio is to his classical prototypes. The inscription, which is right, goes all the way around there. Below the frieze reinforces the jubilation of the putti above. Your birth, O Virgin Mother of God, brought joy to the entire world. Here the putti are explicitly associated with the joy of birth and fecundity. Similar figures appear on the reverse of Deschi di Parto, the trays used to carry food and drink to a mother during her postpartum confinement. Traditionally, the trays were given to a mother prior to the birth of a child or even before conception, and thus served as a kind of talisman for successful procreation. One with a birth scene on the front has a depiction of two music-making infants on the back. The association with fecundity is made even more apparent on trays where children play with pods that contain thousands of poppy seeds. On one tray, two boys are about to strike each other with the pods. The link between fertility and lineage is underscored by the heraldic devices above them. Many of the trays emphasize the importance of having virile masculine offspring through depictions of rough and tumble games, such as the pugilistic battle on one with the Strozzi coat of arms. And I'm sorry I'm showing this in black and white, but after 1902, when it was first photographed, it has disappeared. So perhaps some of you will find it somewhere someday in some attic or something. Lo Scheggio's youth playing Cervettino shows a street game in which players try to avoid slaps while holding down an opponent's feet. And you can see that right there. He's standing on the opponent's feet. Near the bottom of the tray, two toddlers emulate the game with their dog, while on the reverse, two infants grab at each other's hair and penises. Their aggressive action draws explicit attention to their masculinity, while the imagery on the front and the back taken together suggest a steady progress from infancy to childhood to adolescence. Since infant mortality was extremely high, the importance of nurturing robust male heirs, ones who could play such physically demanding games, was of tremendous importance. The emphasis on fecundity and fertility, so prominent on the reverse of Deschi di Parto, can also be seen in a group of small terracotta sculptures of fighting children. And they are small. They're about that big. At the beginning of the 20th century, Wilhelm von Bode placed them in the circle of Donatello and ascribed them to the master of the unruly children. They are now believed to date from around 1520, so almost 100 years later, and are given to the workshop of the virtually unknown Florentine sculptor, Sandro di Lorenzo di Smeraldo. These belligerent babies have laid aside their musical instruments, and you can see down at their feet, they're standing on panpipes and bagpipes or recorders, and they are aggressively pulling hair and biting fingers. The backs of the pears are flat, which indicates that they would have been mounted on a wall. And it's interesting, the one I'm showing you from Berlin is always in all of the literature is said to have been destroyed in World War II. But in fact, it's in deposito, in the storage of the museum in Berlin now. It just was badly damaged during the war, so it still does exist, which is why I could take a picture of its back. Perhaps similar to the frieze in Ghirlandaio's Birth of the Virgin, or it might have been incorporated into a piece of furniture such as that depicted in the Colorice Strozzi portrait. Prominently displayed in a bedchamber, such reliefs would have served as a talisman for expectant mothers, encouraging them to have healthy sons. As Fuccino warned, when a woman imagines or sees, it will get imprinted on the faces of her sons born long afterwards. And even as late as the 17th century, Giulio Mancini advised that certain kinds of pictures kept in bedrooms could arouse a couple to make beautiful, healthy, and charming children. A drawing from the circle of Jacopo Ripanda with an interior view of the mausoleum of Santa Costanza in Rome includes a group of wrestling putti in the foreground that at first glance seems to have been based on an antique sarcophagi. However, on closer inspection, it becomes evident that rather than vying for a palm branch, the pair will be awarded a pinwheel, one of the most popular toys in the Renaissance. And you can see on the sarcophagus there, the two ones that are fighting are going to get that palm branch. But the ones in the drawing are going to get a pinwheel. A strikingly similar group of combative youngsters accompanied by pinwheel-toting friends appear on more than one volume in the early 16th century series of books by Johann Schott. The pinwheels were attached to the long, slender sticks and might be a playful take on the palm of victory fought over by Eros and anti-Eros. Eros, the son of Venus, had refused to grow until he had a brother, and so was given anti-Eros. According to Pausanias, there was a relief on the altar in the gymnasium at Elis, which depicted the brothers locked in combat. Although the altar was no longer extant during the Renaissance, its basic appearance was well known through copies and antique gems. Even in classical literature, the reason for the conflict between the siblings was open to a variety of interpretations concerning the nature of love. They were either seen as struggling to assure that love would be reciprocal, or were bitter enemies locked in an internal battle over love scorned. By the 16th century, they were frequently considered allegories for the contest between spiritual and sensual love. In his 1531 Book of Emblems, Alciato has the virtuous anti-Eros punish his brother by breaking his bow and arrows and letting him feel the burning flames he inflicted on others. And you can see him there. He's sitting blindfolded on the flames. On the other hand, writing in 1556, Vincenzo Cattari described how pictures or statues of young wrestling children were set up in ancient gymnasia to remind youth to respond to love with all their might, which is why anti-Eros struggles to take the palm from the hands of Eros. In later editions, the two are depicted struggling in hand-to-hand combat, which is what you see here. This was the type of reciprocal love that Hymen, the god of marriage, required, without which no couple could be happy. They were not struggling against love, but are locked in a battle for love. Is this then what Titian's putti are doing? There is no palm, but perhaps one is implied by the sharp diagonal axis created by their arms that continues into the highlighted fold of drapery. Are they wrestling, Puti, a symbol of reciprocal love that Clarice will bring to a marriage and an indicator of the healthy progeny that she will produce? Or are they linked in a celebratory dance of maritable joy? Now, you can all vote again. How many think that they are dancing? And how many think that they are fighting? Oh, so we're, overwhelmingly, we're going for fighting. Well, I want to tell you that no matter which way you voted, you're probably correct. For since antiquity, images of music and dance had gone hand in hand with scenes of mock combat. The courage to fight valiantly for love, as Eros and anti-Eros did, ultimately brings joy. Titian has brilliantly articulated the difference between a palpably real toddler and the ethereal, almost vaporous Spiritelli. They are both vestiges of the antique world and, at the same time, spiritual harbingers of the future. At first glance, the adorable Clarice Strozzi may appear to be nothing more than a little girl filled with sugar and spice and all things nice. Yet in reality, Titian's portrait encapsulates all the female virtues of the perfect wife: beauty, chastity, faithfulness, and fecundity. It is a barometer of her potential future, celebrating not who she is, but who she will become. Since she embodies her family's aspirations, it seems relevant to ask whom they might have envisioned as her prospective husband. For like Holbein's vetting portraits of potential brides sent to Henry VIII, or Rubens's presentation of Maria de' Medici's portrait to Henry IV, it seems probable that Roberto Strozzi meant to proffer his daughter in marriage through a picture. There are three possibilities that he might have had in mind. One would have been to wed her in Florence, where the family never stopped hoping to return once a more favorable government had been initiated. Another would have been to marry her to a Venetian patrician, but this would have been more complicated since the Venetian government maintained strict regulations for the registration of all marriages by partisans and so-called outsiders. Each potential bride needed to submit a petition to obtain permission to wed into a family of the ruling elite, and the prospects of acceptance were weighed heavily on the amount of money over the legal limit of 6,000 ducats that would be forthcoming in her negotiated dowry. The third possibility is that despite her tender age, Roberto intended to find a suitable match for her among the members of the French court by sending her portrait to France. While typically Florentine families began to look for a suitable husband when a girl turned 13, at court a match could be made almost at birth. Although not of royal lineage, we have already seen that the Strozzi's cousin, Caterina de' Medici, was able to marry Henri de Valois, the second son of the king. Perhaps it was a similar alliance that Roberto had in mind when he commissioned Clarice's portrait, since we know that the family remained in close contact with the French court. If the plan was to proffer Clarice as a bride, whether in Florence, Venice, or France, what went wrong? We know from Aretino's letter that the picture was finished by the 6th of July, 1542. This is precisely the moment when the Florentine exiles in Venice were thrown into a state of complete and utter chaos. Earlier in the year, Piero Strozzi's forces, as remember her uncle, had captured the small coastal town of Marana near Aquileia, which is, it's right up there, and then here's Venice down here, so it's on that kind of red road that is handily shown there between the two of them. And he captured the town in the name of the French crown. Not only did this displease the Venetians, who saw it rightfully as part of their territory, but they were further troubled to learn that Piero had planned to proceed right down that red brick road into Venice itself in hopes of ceding the city to the French in exchange for control of Florence. On top of this, word leaked out that Piero and Roberto had been passing Venetian state secrets concerning the Ottoman Turks to the French. In August of 1542, Just a month after Titian's portrait was completed, the Strozzi were expelled from the city. Piero remained with the French troops while his wife and children, along with Roberto and his family, found temporary asylum in Ferrara. The contemporary political climate would have made it virtually impossible for Roberto to negotiate a marriage for Clarice in any of the cities in Florence, Venice, or France at that particular moment. By 2 years later, in 1544, Roberto and his family had permanently resettled in Rome. The painting seems to have been a one-off, for there is no indication that Roberto ever commissioned portraits of Clarice's brother or her five younger sisters. At the age of 17, Clarice was promised in marriage to a Roman nobleman, Cristoforo Savelli, and a dowry in excess of 13,000 scudi was agreed upon. In the early 1640s, so almost 100 years later, some 60 years after Clarice's death in 1581, her portrait was lent to one of the yearly exhibitions held at San Giovanni Decollato in Rome, where old master and contemporary paintings were shown side by side. Lorenzo Magliotti, a celebrated philosopher and poet, recounted years later, in fact in 1704, how at the age of four, in the arms of his mother, he had fallen in love with a picture when he saw it at the exhibition. Since the picture was now in Florence, he wrote to the Strozzi family, saying he desperately wanted to commission a copy of the portrait to pair with one of a little boy. Any association of the little blonde girl and her dog with matrimonial prospects had long been forgotten. She was, in Magliotti's eyes, simply the epitome of childhood innocence. Perhaps Magliotti's infatuation with Clarice should not be taken at face value, since his detailed description of the picture appears to be based on Aretino's letter, which he admits to having recently reread. It is therefore fitting, I think, that we let Aretino have the last word. "If I were a painter," he wrote, "I would despair. This painting takes the words from my mouth." Thank you.
This has been a National Gallery of Art podcast.